Welcome to the Mental Minute, an AI-generated podcast. Today, we're taking a closer look at something pretty fascinating in cognitive psychology, functional fixedness.
Right.
We're basing our discussion on a Wikipedia article, and we really want to unpack what it is, where it comes from, and maybe most importantly, how we can, fight back against it in our own thinking.
Exactly. So functional fixedness, it's basically a cognitive bias, kind of a mental roadblock. It stops us from seeing an object used in any way other than its main traditional purpose. You get stuck on the original function, making it hard to find new uses when you're problem solving.
It sounds subtle, but I bet it happens all the time. Like the example you often hear, the hammer.
Oh, yeah, the classic hammer example.
Yeah.
You need a paperweight, maybe papers are flying everywhere, and all you've got nearby is a hammer.
Right.
Functional fixedness is what stops you from just using the hammer to hold the papers down. Your mind is screaming, hammer pounds nails, not hammer holds paper.
So you might just keep looking for something else, even though the solution is right there.
Precisely. And it's interesting where this comes from. It has roots in Gestalt psychology, which is all about how we perceive the whole picture. And studies show we're not actually born with it. Little kids, like five-year-olds, they don't really have this problem.
Really?
Yeah, they're incredibly flexible. An object can do anything it needs to do for them. But then, around age 7, something shifts. Kids start treating an object's main purpose as, well, special. Like, that's the only real way to use it. It's a learned habit.
So if we learn it, maybe we can unlearn it.
That's the hope. And that's really our mission today, right?
Yeah, exactly. We want to understand this mental barrier, look at the classic studies, see how widespread it is, and then get into some real practical techniques to help us all break free from it.
Should be useful for everyday problems, not just big design challenges.
Definitely. Okay, so let's jump into some of that foundational research. The candlebox problem, that's the big one, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Carl Duncker, 1945. It's a cornerstone. So imagine you're brought into a room. You're given a candle, a box of thumbtacks, and some matches. It's the task. Attach the candle to the wall so the wax doesn't drip on the table below.
Right. I can picture people trying to just stick the candle to the wall with tacks or melt the wax.
Exactly. Those were the common first tries. Very few people immediately saw the elegant solution.
Which was?
Empty the thumbtack box, use the box itself as a little shelf for the candle, and then tack the box to the wall.
The box.
Yes. The fixation was on the box being just a container for tacks. That primary function completely blinded people to its potential as a support structure.
That really shows how locked in we can get. And didn't later research add another layer to this? Adamson, in 52.
Yes. Adamson looked at brutalization. He changed how the box was presented.
How so?
He found that if the box was given to people with the tacks already inside, so it was already being used as a container, they were much less likely to solve the puzzle.
Because its function was already established in their minds.
Exactly. But if the box was presented empty, just sitting next to the pile of tacks, people were twice as likely to figure it out.
Wow, just that small change in presentation.
It shows how subtle cues can reinforce or break that fixation.
And then Frank and Ramsgaard took it even further with language, right? Stanford undergrads.
They did. This one's fascinating. They gave students a written version of the problem. And they found that just by underlining certain words, like the word box or matches, significantly more students solved it.
Just underlining, not even changing the words.
Just underlining.
Yeah.
It suggests that highlighting the word box itself, sort of separate from its container context, maybe briefly disrupts that automatic association we have with its function. Our mental dictionary is more than just definitions, you know.
Huh. That's incredibly subtle.
Mm.
Okay, let's shift gears to another classic, the two-chord problem, adapted by Birch and Rabinowitz.
Right, from Mayer's earlier work. This one's all about ingenuity in a physical space. So you're in a room, two chords hanging from the ceiling, too far apart to grab both at once.
Okay, I remember this one. You have to somehow get them together.
Exactly. The only solution is to tie something heavy to one chord, swing it like a pendulum, catch it while holding the other chord.
And the heavy objects they provided were pretty specific, weren't they?
They were. An electrical switch and an electrical relay. And here's the clever part. The experimenters had different groups. One group used the relay first in an unrelated electrical task. Another group used the switch first. And a control group did nothing electrical beforehand.
Okay, so they pre-used one of the potential weights for its actual electrical purpose.
Precisely. And the results were really quite surprising. People strongly tended to use the object they hadn't just used electrically as the pendulum weight.
So if you just wired up the relay, you'd probably grab the switch to swing, even if the relay was just as heavy.
That's exactly what happened. It's like their brain labeled the object. This is an electrical part, not a weight. The recent experience fixed its function.
Wow.
And when asked why, people would often rationalize it, saying the one they chose was better for swinging, even when it wasn't true. Our recent experiences really steer us, often unconsciously.
That's powerful stuff. Okay, one more famous example of the barometer question. Alexander Calandra. This one kind of flips the script, doesn't it?
It really does. It's a fantastic illustration, maybe showing the examiner's fixedness as much as anything.
Right.
The question was simple. Show how to determine the height of a tall building using a barometer.
And the teacher expected the standard physics answer, using air pressure differences.
Right. But the student came back with all these other perfectly valid creative answers.
Like what?
Oh, things like drop the barometer from the roof and time its fall. Or measure the barometer, then measure the building shadow and the barometer shadow and use ratios. Or even offer the barometer to the building superintendent in exchange for the building's height from the blueprints. Or just use the barometer's length to measure the building inch by inch.
Those are brilliant, but maybe not what the physics test was looking for.
Exactly. The student showed amazing flexible thinking, but the examiner was fixated on the one way a barometer is supposed to be used in that context. It's a great reminder to question the correct way and ask, what else could this thing do?
It really makes you wonder about this kind of thinking. Is it just a modern problem because we have so many specialized tools? Or is it more fundamental? Like, is functional fixedness universal?
That's a really important question. And German and Barrett looked into this back in 2005. They studied the Shuar people in the Ecuadorian Amazon.
Okay, hunter horticulturalists. So presumably less exposure to single-purpose high-tech gadgets.
Exactly. They tend to use a smaller set of low-tech tools, but often repurpose them in very clever ways for different tasks. You might think they'd be immune to functional fixedness.
Makes sense. So what tasks did the researchers use?
They used tasks designed to be culturally appropriate, but conceptually similar to the Western ones, like a box task for building a tower and a spoon task to solve a problem for a little story character.
And did the Shuar show less functional fixedness because of their adaptable tool use?
This is the really striking part.
What?
No, they didn't.
Wow.
Even in this culture, with relatively few artifacts, people were still susceptible. If the main purpose of an object was explained beforehand, they were slower and less likely to use it in a new way to solve the problem. Even though in their daily lives, they do repurpose tools frequently.
So it's not just about the technology around us. It seems to be a deeper cognitive tendency.
It really suggests it might be a fundamental way our brains categorize and try to make sense of the world efficiently, regardless of the specific culture or technology level. Those mental models of objects run deep.
Yeah, quite humbling. Okay, so if it's this universal, how does it affect things like creativity and design? You mentioned research on fixation effects.
By Chriscu and Weisberg, 2005. They looked at how showing examples during the design process can sometimes backfire.
Backfire how? Like, if you show a bad example.
Exactly. Say you're teaching design students, and you show them a picture of a badly designed, leaky coffee cup to illustrate pitfalls.
You'd think that would help them avoid those mistakes.
You would. But Chriscu and Weisberg found it can actually cause fixation. By highlighting the problematic aspects, you inadvertently make the students focus on those flawed features, making it harder for them to imagine something completely different and truly innovative.
So showing the leaky cup makes it harder to think of a non-leaky one.
Pretty much. Their minds get stuck on the features you showed them, even as negative examples. They tested this with things like spill-proof cups, bike racks, cream cheese containers.
Okay.
But, crucially, they also found a way around it. Defixating instructions.
Defixating instructions. Tell me more.
These are explicit instructions about what design elements to avoid. So instead of just showing the bad cup, you'd say, okay, when you design yours, do not use a wide-open top like this one. Or avoid single points of contact on the bike rack.
Ah, so you actively point out the thing to steer clear of.
Precisely. And giving those explicit don't do this instructions significantly reduced the fixation effect and helped students come up with better, more creative solutions.
Yeah.
It shows that being told what not to do can be really freeing.
That's a fantastic insight for anyone teaching or mentoring creativity. Okay, so we know it's pervasive. We know it can hinder design. What can we do about it? Are there actual techniques we can use?
Yes, definitely. And cognitive science has explored quite a few. One interesting area is using analogies better, especially in learning, like in science classrooms. Solomon looked at this in 94.
Analogies, how do they help with fixedness?
Well, it's about how you present them. Instead of just saying electricity is like water in pipes, you frame the analogy as a problem and focus on the underlying structure.
Okay, like?
Like you might pose a problem. Imagine a complex plumbing system with blockages. How would you figure out where the water flow is stuck? This makes the student map the deep structure of the plumbing problem onto the electrical circuit problem.
Ah, so you're transferring the problem-solving approach, not just the surface comparison.
Exactly. It helps them see the abstract principles, overcoming fixation on the specific objects involved. It's about crafting analogies carefully.
That makes sense. What about for people actually designing things, engineers or artists?
For them, Latour talked about uncommitting. It's about consciously stepping back from your initial design ideas or how you first conceptualize something.
Uncommitting, like detaching yourself from the first draft.
Sort of, but it's more about dissecting the purpose of each element. Latour used software engineers as an example. Say they want to take a piece of code from a quicksort algorithm to make a new general partitioning function. They don't just copy it.
Right.
They look at each line, figure out its fundamental purpose in the original algorithm, and then decide if that exact purpose is needed for the new function. They separate the why from the original how.
So keep the essential function, but free it from its first fixed form.
Precisely. It stops you from getting locked into the initial implementation and allows for more flexibility.
That's a really useful mental discipline. What about tackling our basic mental prototypes of objects?
Carnevale's work in 98 speaks to that. He found successful problem solvers look beyond the obvious prototype.
Mm-hmm.
His suggested technique is pretty hands-on. You take the object, you mentally break it down into its parts. Then, for each part, you brainstorm all the possible functions that part could have, separate from the whole object.
Okay, so like with scissors, don't just think cutting. Think. Two blades, a pivot, handles. What can a blade do? Pry, scrape. What can a pivot do? What can a handle loop do? Hang something.
Exactly. You're disassembling it in your mind to see the raw potential of the components. It forces you past the object's main identity.
I like that. And finally, there was McCaffrey's generic parts technique from 2012. This sounded very systematic.
It really is. Probably the most structured approach. The idea is to systematically strip away function from form as you break an object down. You have two questions for each part. Can I break this down further and... critically, does my description imply a use?
And if it does imply a use?
You have to make the description more generic. Focus only on shape, material, basic properties. Get rid of any word that hints at its job.
Could you walk through that with, say, a candle?
Sure. Start with candle, break it down. Wick and wax. Okay, wick. Does that imply a use? Yes. Burning, so generalize. A wick is a string.
Okay.
Does string imply a use? Yes. Tying, pulling. Generalize further. What is it physically... interwoven fibrous strands. Now, that's pretty generic.
Right. No function implied there.
No. The wax. Wax implies melting. Maybe sealing. Generalized. Maybe solid fatty substance. Still a bit function related. Let's go for form and material. Cylindrical, malleable, solid.
Ah, okay. So you end up with interwoven fibrous strands and a cylindrical, malleable, solid.
Exactly. Now, your mind isn't locked into candle. It can ask. What else can I do with fibrous strands? What else could I use a malleable cylinder for? A stopper. A mold.
That's brilliant. It forces you to see the raw materials and shapes.
And it works. McCaffrey found people trained in this solve 67% more functional fixedness problems. It really helps decouple function from form.
That's a huge improvement. A really practical tool. So wrapping this up, functional fixedness is clearly a big deal. It's this common mental trap affects us all across cultures.
But crucially, it's not insurmountable. It's a habit we can counteract.
Right. By using these kinds of techniques, thinking about analogies structurally, uncommitting from initial ideas, breaking things down into parts, especially using that generic parts technique, we can actually get better at seeing new possibilities.
Definitely. It's about consciously pushing back against that automatic tendency to see only the obvious function. It can help with big creative projects, sure, but also just everyday little problems.
Absolutely. So we really hope you try applying some of these ideas next time you feel stuck. Think about the objects around you differently. It might just unlock something unexpected, which leads to a final thought to leave you with. What common object in your daily life could be secretly hiding a totally different, undiscovered purpose? That's all for this episode. Thanks for tuning in.